Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Talent by Robert Bloch. It is perhaps a pity that nothing is known of Andrew Benson's parents. The same reasons which prompted them to leave him as a foundling on the steps of the St. Andrew's Orphanage also caused them to maintain a discreet anonymity. The event occurred on the morning of March 3, 1943. The war era, as you probably recall, so in a way the child may be regarded as a wartime casualty. Similar occurrences were by no means rare during those days, even in Pasadena, where the orphanage was located. After the usual tentative and fruitless inquiries, the good sisters took him in. It was there that he acquired his first name, from the patron and patronymic saint of the establishment. The Benson was added some years later by the couple who eventually adopted him. It is difficult at this late date to determine what sort of a child Andrew was. Orphanage records are sketchy at best, and Sister Rosemarie, who acted as supervisor of the boys' dormitory, is long since dead. Sister Albertine, the primary grades teacher of the orphanage school, is now, to put it as delicately as possible, in her senility, and her testimony is necessarily colored by knowledge of subsequent events. That Andrew never learned to talk until he was nearly 7 years old seems almost incredible. The forced gregarity and the conspicuous lack of individual attention characteristic of orphanage upbringing would make it appear as though the ability to speak is necessary for actual survival in such an environment from infancy onward. Scarcely more credible is Sister Albertine's theory that Andrew knew how to talk, but merely refused to do so until he was well into his 7th year. For what it is worth, she now remembers him as an unusually precocious youngster, who appeared to possess an intelligence and understanding far beyond his years. Instead of employing speech, however, he relied on pantomime, an art at which he was so brilliantly adept, if Sister Albertine is to be believed, that his continuing silence seems scarcely noticeable. He could imitate anybody, she declares. The other children, the sisters, even the Mother Superior. Of course, I had to punish him for that. But it was remarkable the way he was able to pick up all the little mannerisms and facial expressions of another person, just at a glance. And that's all it took for Andrew, just a mere glance. Visitors' Day was Sunday. Naturally, Andrew never had any visitors, but he liked to hang around the corridor and watch them come in. And afterwards, in the dormitory at night, he'd put in a regular performance for the other boys. He could impersonate every single man, woman, or child who'd come to the orphanage that day. The way they walked, the way they moved, every action and gesture. Even though he never said a word, nobody made the mistake of thinking Andrew was mentally deficient. For a while, Dr. Clement had the idea he might be a mute. Dr. Roger Clement is one of the few persons who might be able to furnish more objective data concerning Andrew Benson's early years. Unfortunately, he passed away in 1954, a victim of a fire which also destroyed his home and his office files. It was Dr. Clement who attended Andrew on the night that he saw his first motion picture. The date was 1949, some Saturday evening, in the late fall of the year. The orphanage received and showed one film a week, and only children of school age were permitted to attend. Andrew's inability or unwillingness to speak had caused some difficulty when he entered primary grades that September, and several months went by before he was allowed to join his classmates in the auditorium for the Saturday night screenings. But it is known that he eventually did so. The picture was the last and probably the least of the Marx Brothers movies. Its title was Love Happy, and if it is remembered by the general public at all today, that is due to the fact that the film contained a brief walk-in appearance by a then-unknown blonde bit player named Marilyn Monroe. But the orphanage audience had other reasons for regarding it as memorable, because Love Happy was the picture that sent Andrew Benson into his trance. Long after the lights came up again in the auditorium, the child sat there, immobile, his eyes staring glassily at the blank screen. When his companions noticed and sought to arouse him, he did not respond. One of the sisters, possibly Sister Rosemary, shook him, and he promptly collapsed in a dead faint. Dr. Clement was summoned, and he administered to the patient. Andrew Benson did not recover consciousness until the following morning, and it was then that he talked. He talked immediately. He talked perfectly. He talked fluently, but not in the manner of a six-year-old child. The voice that issued from his lips was that of a middle-aged man. It was a nasal, rasping voice, and even without the accompanying grimaces and facial expressions, it was instantaneously and unmistakably recognizable as the voice of Groucho Marx. Andrew Benson mimicked Groucho in his Sam Grunion role to the perfection, word for word. Then he did Chico Marx. After that, he relapsed into silence again, mute phase. But it was an eloquent silence, and soon it became evident that he was imitating Harpo. In rapid succession, Andrew created recognizable vocal and visual portraits of Raymond Burr, Melville Cooper, Eric Bloor, and the other actors who played small roles in the picture. His impersonations seemed uncanny to his companions, and the sisters were not unimpressed. Why, he even looked like Groucho, Sister Albertine insists, ignoring the question of how a tow-headed moppet of six can achieve a physical resemblance to Groucho Marx without benefit or detriment of makeup. It is nevertheless an established fact that Andrew Benson gained immediate celebrity as a mimic within the small confines of the orphanage. And from that moment on, he talked regularly, if not freely. That is to say, he replied to direct questions. He recited his lessons in the classroom and responded with the outward forms of politeness required by orphanage discipline. But he was never loquacious or even communicative in the ordinary sense. The only time he became spontaneously articulate was immediately following the showing of a weekly movie. There was no reoccurrence of his initial seizure, but each Saturday night screening brought in its wake a complete dramatic recapitulation by the gifted youngster. During the fall of 49 and winter of 50, Andrew Benson saw many movies. There was Sorrowful Jones with Bob Hope, Tarzan's Magic Fountain, The Fighting O'Flynn, The Life of Riley, Little Women, and a number of other films, current and older. Naturally, these pictures were subject by approval by the sisters before being shown. As a result, movies depicting or emphasizing violence were not included. Still, several westerns reached the orphanage screen, and it is significant that Andrew Benson reacted in what was to become a characteristic fashion. Funny thing, declares Albert Dominguez, who attended the orphanage during the same period as Andrew Benson, and is one of the few persons located who is willing to admit, let alone discuss, the fact. At first, Andy imitated everybody. All the men, that is. He never imitated none of the women. But after he started to see westerns, it got so he was choosy, like. He just imitated the villains. I don't mean like when us guys was playing cowboys, you know, when one guy is a sheriff and one is a gunslinger. I mean, he imitated villains all the time. He could talk like him. He could even look like him. We used to razz the hell out of him, you know. It's probably as a result of the razzing that Andrew Benson, on the evening of May 17, 1950, attempted to slit the throat of Frank Phillips with a table knife. Probably, although Albert Dominguez claims that the older boy offered no provocation and that Andrew Benson was exactly duplicating the screen role of a Western desperado in an old Charles Sterrett movie. The incident was hushed up, apparently, and no action taken. We have little information on Andrew Benson's growth and development between the summer of 1950 and the autumn of 1955. Dominguez left the orphanage. Nobody else appears willing to testify, and Sister Albertine had retired to a rest home. As a result, there's nothing available concerning what may well have been Andrew's crucial formative years. The meager records of his classwork seem satisfactory enough, and there is nothing to indicate that he was a disciplinary problem to his instructors. In June of 1955, he was photographed with the rest of his classmates upon the occasion of graduation from 8th grade. His face is a mere blur, an almost blank smudge in a sea of pre-adolescent countenances. What he actually looked like at that age is hard to tell. The Bensons thought that he resembled their son, David. Little David Benson had died of polio in 1953, and 2 years later his parents came to St. Andrew's Orphanage seeking to adopt a boy. They had David's picture with them, and they were frank to state that they sought a physical resemblance as a guide to make their choice. Did Andrew Benson see that photograph? Did, as has been subsequently theorized by certain irresponsible alarmists, he see certain home movies which the Bensons had taken of their child? We must confine ourselves to the known facts, which are simply that Mr. and Mrs. Lewis Benson of Pasadena, California, legally adopted Andrew Benson, age 12, on December 9, 1955. And Andrew Benson went to live in their home as their son. He entered the public high school. He became the owner of a bicycle. He received an allowance of $1 a week, and he went to the movies. Andrew Benson went to the movies, and there were no restrictions. No restrictions at all. For several months, that is. During this period, he saw comedies, dramas, westerns, musicals, melodramas. He must have seen melodramas. Was there a film released early in 1956 in which an actor played the role of a gangster who pushed a victim out of a second-story window? Knowing what we do today, we must suspect that there must have been. But at the time, when the actual incident occurred, Andrew Benson was virtually exonerated. He and the other boy had been scuffling in a classroom after school, and the boy had accidentally fallen. At least, this is the official version of the affair. The boy, now Private Raymond Schuyler, USMC, maintains to this day that Benson deliberately tried to kill him. He was spooky, that kid, Schuyler insists. None of us ever really got close to him. It was like there was nothing to get close to, you know? I mean, he kept changing off so. From one day to the next, you could never figure out what he was going to be like. Of course, we all knew he imitated these movie actors. He was only a freshman, but already he was a big shot in the dramatic club. But it was as though he imitated all the time. One minute, he'd be real quiet, and the next, wham! You know that story? The one about Jekyll and Hyde? Well, that was Andrew Benson. Afternoon, he grabbed me. We weren't even talking to each other. He just came up at me at the window, and I swear to God, he changed right before my eyes. It was as if he all of a sudden got about a foot taller and 50 pounds heavier, and his face was real wild. He pushed me out the window without one word. Of course, I was scared spitless, and maybe I just thought he changed. I mean, nobody can actually do a thing like that, can they? This question, if it arose at all at the time, remained unanswered. We do know that Andrew Benson was brought to the attention of Dr. Max Feringer, child psychiatrist and part-time guidance counselor at the school, and his initial examination disclosed no apparent abnormalities of personality or behavior patterns. Dr. Feringer did, however, have several long talks with the Bensons, and as a result, Andrew was forbidden to attend motion pictures. The following year, Dr. Feringer voluntarily offered to examine young Andrew. Undoubtedly, his interest had been aroused by the amazing dramatic abilities the boy was showing in his extracurricular activities at the school. Only one such interview ever took place, and it is to be regretted that Dr. Feringer neither committed his findings to paper nor communicated them to the Bensons before a sudden shocking death at the hands of an unknown assailant. It is believed, or was believed by the police at the time, that one of his former patients committed to an institution as a psychotic may have been guilty of the crime. All that we know is that it occurred some short while following a local rerun of the film Man in the Attic, in which Jack Palance essayed the role of Jack the Ripper. It is interesting today to examine some of the so-called horror movies of those years, including the reruns of earlier vehicles starring Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, Peter Lorre, and a number of other actors. We cannot say with any certainty, of course, that Andrew Benson was violating the wishes of his foster parents and secretly attending motion pictures. But if he did, it is quite likely that he would frequent the smaller neighborhood houses, many of which specialized in reruns. And we do know from the remarks of fellow classmates during his high school years that Andy was familiar, almost omnisciently so, with the mannerisms of these performers. The evidence is oftentimes conflicting. Joan Charters, for example, is willing to swear on a stack of Bibles that Andrew Benson, at the age of 15, was a dead ringer for Peter Lorre, the same bug eyes and everything. whereas Nick Dossinger, who attended classes with Benson a year later, insists that he looked just like Boris Karloff. Granted that adolescence may bring about a considerable increase in height during the period of a year, it is nevertheless difficult to imagine how a dead ringer for Peter Lorre could metamorphosize into an aesthetic Karloff type. A massive testimony is available concerning Andrew Benson during those years, but almost all of it deals with his phenomenal histrionic talent and his startling skill at ad-lib impersonation of motion picture actors. Apparently, he had given up mimicking his associates and contemporaries almost entirely. He said he liked to do actors better because they were bigger, says Don Brady, who appeared with him in the senior play. I asked him what he meant by bigger, and he said it was just that. Actors were bigger on the screen, sometimes 20 feet tall, he said. Why bother with little people when you can be big? Oh, he was a real offbeat character, that one. The phrases recur. Oddball and screwball and real gone are picturesque but hardly enlightening. There seems to be little recollection of Andrew Benson as a friend or classmate in the ordinary role of adolescence. It's the imitator who is remembered, with admiration and frequently with distaste bordering on actual apprehension. He was so good he scared you. But that's when he was doing those impersonations, of course. The rest of the time you scarcely knew he was around. Classes? I guess he did all right. I didn't notice him much. Andrew was a fair student. He could recite when called upon, but he never volunteered. His marks were average. I got the impression he was rather withdrawn. No, he never dated much. Come to think of it, I don't think he went out with girls at all. I never paid much attention to him, except when he was on stage, of course. I wasn't really what you call close to Andy. I don't know anybody who seemed to be friends with him. He was so quiet, outside of the dramatics. And when he got up there, it was like he was a different person. He was real great, you know. We all figured he'd end up at the Pasadena Playhouse. The reminiscences of his contemporaries are frequently apt to touch upon matters which did not directly involve Andrew Benson. The years 1956 and 1957 are still remembered by high school students of the area in particular as the years of the curfew. It was a voluntary curfew, of course, but it was nevertheless strictly observed by most of the female students during the period of the werewolf murders, that series of savage, still unsolved crimes which terrorized the community for well over a year. Certain cannibalistic aspects of the slaying of the five young women led to the werewolf appellation on the part of the sensation-mongering press. The Wolfman series made by Universal had been revived, and perhaps this had something to do with the association. But to return to Andrew Benson. He grew up, went to school, and lived the normal life of a dutiful stepson. If his foster parents were a bit strict, he made no complaints. If they punished him because they suspect he sometimes slipped out of his room at night, he made no complaint or denials. If they seemed apprehensive, lest he be disobeying their set injunctions not to attend the movies, he offered no overt defiance. The only known clash between Andrew Benson and his family came about as a result of their flat refusal to allow a television set in their home. Whether or not they were concerned about the possible encouragement of Andrew's mimicry, or whether they had merely developed an allergy to Lawrence Welk and his ilk is difficult to determine. Nevertheless, they balked at the acquisition of a TV set. Andrew begged and pleaded, pointed out that he needed television as an aid to a future dramatic career. His argument had some justification for his senior year. Andrew had indeed been scouted by the famous Pasadena Playhouse, and there was even some talk of a future professional career without the necessity of formal training. But the Bensons were adamant on the television question. As far as we can determine, they remained adamant right up to the day of their death. The unfortunate circumstances occurred at Balboa, where the Bensons owned a small cottage and maintained a little cabin cruiser. The elder Bensons and Andrew were heading for Catalina Channel when the cruiser overturned in choppy waters. Andrew managed to cling to the craft until rescued, but his foster parents were gone. It was a common enough accident. You've probably seen something just like it in the movies a dozen times. Andrew, just turned 18, was left an orphan once more, but an orphan in full possession of a lovely home, and with the expectation of coming into a sizable inheritance when he reached 21. The Benson estate was administered by the family attorney, Justin L. Fowler, and he placed young Andrew on an allowance of $40 a week, an amount sufficient for a recent graduate of high school to survive on, but hardly enough to maintain him in luxury. It is to be feared that violent scenes were precipitated between the young man and his attorney. There is no point in recapitulating them here or in condemning Fowler for what may seem, on the surface of it, to be the development of a fixation. But up until the night that he was struck down by a hit-and-run driver in the street before his house, Attorney Fowler seemed almost obsessed with a desire to prove that Benson Ladd was illegally incompetent, or worse. Indeed, it was his investigation which led to the uncovering of what new facts are presentably available concerning the life of Andrew Benson. Certain other hypotheses. One hesitates to dignify them with the term conclusions. He apparently extrapolated from these meager findings or fabricated them out of thin air, unless, of course, he did manage to discover details which he never actually disclosed. Without the support of such details, there is no way of authenticating what seemed to be a series of fantastic conjectures. A random sampling, as remembered from various conversations Fowler had with the authorities, will suffice. I don't think the kid is even human, for that matter. Just because he showed up on those orphanage steps, you call him a foundling? Changeling might be a better word for it. Yes, I know they don't believe in such things anymore. And if you talk about life forms from another planet, they laugh at you and tell you to join the Fordian Society. So happens I'm a member. Changeling? It's probably a more accurate term than the narrow meaning implies. I'm talking about the way he changes when he sees these movies. No, don't take my word for it. Ask anyone who's ever seen him act. Better still, ask those who never saw him on a stage but just watched him imitate movie performers in private. You'll find out he did a lot more than just imitate. He becomes the actor. Yes, I mean, he undergoes an actual physical transformation. Chameleon, or some other form of life. Who can say? No, I don't pretend to understand it. I know it's not scientific according to the way you define science, but that doesn't mean it's impossible. There are a lot of life forms in the universe, and we can only guess at some of them. Why shouldn't there be one that's abnormally sensitive to mimicry? You know what effects the movies can have on so-called normal human beings under certain conditions? It's a hypnotic state, this movie viewing, and you can ask the psychologist for confirmation. Darkness, concentration, suggestion, all the elements are present. And there's post-hypnotic suggestion, too. Again, psychiatrists will back me up on that. Most people tend to identify with various characters on the screen. That's where our hero worship comes in. That's why we have Western movie fans and detective fans and all the rest. Supposedly, ordinary people come out of the theater and fantasy themselves as the heroes and heroines they saw up there on the screen. Imitate them, too. That's what Andrew Benson did, of course. Only suppose he could carry it one step further. Suppose he was capable of being what he saw portrayed, and he chose to be the villains. I tell you, it's time to investigate those killings of a few years back, all of them. Not just the murder of those girls, but the murder of the two doctors who examined Benson when he was a child, and the death of his foster parents, too. I don't think any of these things were accidents. I think some people got too close to the secret, and Benson put them out of the way. Why? How should I know why? Any more than I know what he's looking for when he watches the movies. But he's looking for something, I can guarantee that. Who knows what purpose such a life form can have, or what he intends to do with his power? All I can do is warn you. It is easy to dismiss Attorney Fowler as a paranoid type, though perhaps unfair, and that we cannot evaluate the reasons for his outburst. That he knew, or believed he knew, something is self-evident. As a matter of fact, on the very evening of his death, he was apparently about to put his findings on paper. Deplorably, all that he ever set down was a preamble in the form of a quotation from Eric Voegelin concerning rigid pragmatic attitudes of scientism, so-called, 1. The assumption that the mathematized science of natural phenomena is a model science to which all other sciences ought to conform. 2. That all realms of being are accessible to the methods of the sciences of phenomena. And 3. That all reality which is not accessible to sciences of phenomena is either irrelevant or, in the more radical form of the dogma, illusionary. But Attorney Fowler is dead, and we deal with the living, with Max Schick, for example. The motion picture and television agent who visited Andrew Benson at his home shortly after the death of the elder Bensons and offered him an immediate contract. "You're a natural," Schick declared. "Never mind with a Pasadena Playhouse bit. I can spot you right now, believe me. With what you got, we'll back Brando right off the map. Of course we've got to start small, but I know just the gimmick. Main thing is to establish you in a starring slot right away. None of this stock contract jazz, get me? The studios aren't handing them out anymore in the first place. And even if you landed one, all it would do is you'd end up on cloud nowhere. No, the deal is to get you a lead and billing right off the bat. And like I said, I got the angle. We go to a small independent producer, get it? Must be a dozen of them operating right now, and all of them making the same thing. Only one kind of picture that combines low budgets with big grosses, and that's a science fiction movie. Yeah, you heard me, a science fiction movie. What do you mean? You never saw one? Are you kidding? How about that? You mean you never saw any science fiction pictures at all? Oh, you're folks, huh? Had to sneak out? And the only show that kind of stuff in the downtown houses? Well, look, kid, it's about time. That's all I can say. It's about time. Hey, just so you know what we're talking about, you better get on the ball and take in one right away. Sure, I'm positive. There must be one playing a downtown first run now. Why don't you go this afternoon? I got some work to finish up here at the office. Run you down in my car, and you can go on to the show. Meet me back here when you get out. Sure, you can take the car after you drop me off. Be my guest. So Andrew Benson saw his first science fiction movie. He drove there and back in Max Schick's car. Coincidentally enough, it was the late afternoon of the day when Attorney Fowler became a hit-and-run victim. And Schick had good reason to remember Andrew Benson's appearance at his office just after dusk. He had a look on his face that was out of this world, Schick says. How'd you like the picture? I ask him. It was wonderful, he tells me. Just what I've been looking for all these years. And to think I didn't know. Didn't know what? I ask. But he isn't talking to me anymore. You can see that. He's talking to himself. I thought there must be something like that, he says. Something better than Dracula or Frankenstein's monster or all the rest. Something bigger, more powerful. Something I could really be. And now I know. And now I'm going to. Max Schick is unable to maintain coherency from this point on, but his direct account is not necessary. We are unfortunately all too well aware of what happened next. Max Schick sat there in his chair and watched Andrew Benson change. He watched him grow. He watched him put forth the eyes, the stalks, the writhing tentacles. He watched him twist and tower, filling this room and then overflowing until the flimsy stucco walls collapsed and there was nothing but the green gigantic horror, the 60-foot-high monstrosity that may have been born in a screenwriter's brain or may have been spawned beyond the stars, but certainly existed and drew nourishment from realms far from a three-dimensional world or three-dimensional concepts of sanity. Max Schick will never forget that night, and neither, of course, will anybody else. That was the night the monster destroyed Los Angeles. The Island of the Ood by William Hope Hodgson. P.B. Tall's cabin boy and deckhand stood to leeward of the half-poop and stared silently at the island, incredibly lonely against her translucence of the early dawn, a place of lonesome and mysterious silence, with strange birds of the sea wheeling and crying over it, and making the silence but the more apparent. Away to windward, Captain Jat, his master, stood stiff and erect against the growing light, all his leathery length of 6 feet 5 inches set into a kind of grim attention as he stared at the black shadow upon the sea that lay off his weather bow. The minutes passed slowly, and the dawn seemed to dream, stirred to reality only by the far and chill sounds of the birds crying so drearily. The small bark crept on, gathering the slight morning airs to her aid, while the dawn shine grew subtly and strengthened up, so that the island darkened the more against it for a little while, and grew stealthily more real. And all the time, above it, the seabirds swung about in noiseless circling against the gold of light that hung now in all the lower sky. Presently there came the hoarse hail of the lookout man, who must have waked suddenly. "Land on the weather bow, sir!" But the lean, grim-looking figure to the windward vouchsafed no reply beyond a low growl of contempt. And all the time Pibby Talls, the boy, stared, overwhelmed with strange imaginings, treasure, monsters, lovely women, weirdness, unutterable terror brooding beyond all powers of his imagination to comprehend. He had listened to some marvelously strange things when Captain Jat had been in drink, for it was often then the captain's whim to make the boy sit at the table with him and dip his cup likewise in the toddy bowl. And presently, when Captain Jat had drunk his toddy steadily out of the big pewter mug, he would begin to talk, rambling on in garrulous fashion from tale to tale, and at last, as like as not, mixing them quite inextricably. And as he talked, the long, lean man would throw his glance back over his shoulder suspiciously every minute or so, perhaps bid the boy go up the little half-poop and discover the whereabouts of the officer of the watch, and then into the cabin of the officer, whose watch it might chance to be below, so to make sure that neither of his mates were tending listening ears on the sly. "Don't ever tell the mates, boy," he would say to Pibby Talls, "or I'll sure maul you. They'd be wanting profits." For that was, in the main, the substance of all his talks. Treasure, that is to say, to be exact, treasure and women. "Never a word, boy. I trust you, but no one else in this packet." And truly, Captain Jat did seem to have a trust in the boy, for in his cups he told him everything that came up his muddled mind, and always the boy would listen with a vast interest, putting in an odd question this time and that to keep the talk running. And indeed, it suited him very well, for though he could never tell how much to believe or how little, he was very well pleased to be sitting drinking his one cup of toddy slowly in the cabin, instead of being out on the deck doing shipwork. It is true that the captain appeared both to like the boy in his own queer fashion and to trust him. For all that, he had with perfect calmness and remorseless intent shown him the knife with which he would cut his throat if he ever told a word of anything that his master might say to him during his drinking bouts. Captain Jat's treatment of the lad was curious in many ways. He had him sleep in a little cabin aback the mate's, where through the open door he could see the boy in his bunk. When he ran out of toddy, he would heave his pewter mug at the lad's head as he lay asleep, and roar to him to bring him more fresh brew and stronger. But this trick of the captain's was no trouble to Pibby, for he rigged a dummy oakum head to the end of his bunk, which showed through the open doorway, and slept then the other way about. And so, with this little that I've told you, may know something of the life aft in the cabin of the little bark galot, which vessel belonged stick and keel to Captain Jat, and some pretty rum doings there were aboard of her, first and last, as you may now have chance to judge. At times, another side of Captain Jat would break out, and he would spend the whole of a watch having a gorgeous pistol-shooting match against Peeby, and a wonderful good shot the boy was, both by natural eye and by the training he had his way. In the end, the boy became a better shot than Captain Jat himself, who was an extraordinarily fine marksman, though somewhat unequal. Yet, for all that Peeby beat him time after time, this peculiar man showed no annoyance, but persisted in the matches, as if his primary intention were to make the boy an expert with a weapon. And indeed, I've little doubt but that this was his real desire. Now, although Pibby Talls had tremendously confused and vague ideas as to what strangeness of mystery was concerned with the island, yet he knew perfectly that it was no chance that had brought them that way, for all the captain's talks over his toddy had gone to show that the true aim of the voyage was to bring up near the island for some purpose that the lad could only guess at in a mystified way, owing to the muddling fashion in which Captain Jat had run his yarns one into another, treasure, women, monsters, and odd times a queer habit of muttering to himself about his little priestess, and once he had broken out into a kind of hazy ramble about the Oud, rolling his eyes at the boy strangely and gesticulating so impressively with his pewter mug that he managed to spread his toddy in an unprejudiced manner over PB, the table, and the floor generally. Therefore, having, as I have said, a sure knowledge that the island they approached was the real goal of the voyages, though there was an honest enough cargo below hatches, you may imagine something of PB's blank astonishment when Captain Jat allowed the bark to sail quietly past, touching neither brace, sheet, nor tack, so that by the time morning was full come, the island lay upon the weather quarter and presently far away astern. Yet, as they had gone past, the lad had studied it very eagerly, and had seen in the light of the coming day that it was wooded almost everywhere, even close down to the shores, with a long, bold reef of stark rock running out in a great sweep upon the south side, so that a plain boat could be landed there very safely and easily under its lee. The island, Pibby had noticed, rose towards the center into a low, seemingly flat-topped hill, with a forest of great trees very heavy on its slopes. All the morning the Galat stood to the southward until they had sunk the island below the horizon, then hove to then and drifted until near evening, where they filled once more on her and stood back to the northward. By four bells that night they sighted the island, looking like a doleful smudge in the darkness away to the northeast. Presently the bark was put in irons, and orders given to lower the dinghy. When she was in the water, Captain Jat flipped Pibby on the ear and growled to him to jump down into the boat. The boy climbed over, and Captain Jack followed, after having first directed the second mate, whose watch it was, to reach out into the open and run in against about midnight. The captain took the after oar and rowed standing up with his face to the bows, while Pibby, the boy, took the bow oar and rowed sitting down. "Easy with that oar, boy," said Captain Jack presently, after he had pulled a while. "Put your shirt round it," and this Pibby had to do, and row naked to the waist, while his shirt muffled the sound of his oar between the thole-pins. But, after all, the night was pretty warm. Meanwhile the captain had pulled off his own coat and ripped out one of the sleeves, which he reeved onto his oar and so made it silent as a lad's. And this was the way, almost quietly as a shadow boat in the darkness, they came in presently under the shelter of the great barrier reef, and very soon then to the uncomfortable silence of the shore under the dark trees that came down so near to the sea. Here, before Captain Jat landed, he bid the boy lay on his oar while he listened, but they could hear nothing except the far dull booming of the sea upon the exposed beach beyond the great reef, the solemn noise of the sea coming very hushed and distant to them, and blending with the dreary little sounds that came out of the near forest as the night airs went wandering on into its gloom. "Keep her afloat till I come, boy," said Captain Jat, as he stepped ashore. He walked a few paces up the beach, settling a brace of great double-barreled pistols in his belt. Then he turned sharply and came back. "Not a sound, boy, or you're as good as dead," he said grimly in a low tone. "Not a sound. So, what you hears, keep off there in the shadow of the reef. You hear me squark like a catch molly hawk when I come. Keep your eyes wide open, boy." And with that, he slewed round on his heel and went up pretty quick across the sand into the darkness of the black trees. Pibby Talls, the boy, stood in the bows of the boat and stared after him, listening to the vague sounds of his passage, growing ever distant and more distant, but odd, while sounding out clear through the dark forest, as some dried kippin snapped under his weight. Then as Captain Jat went further and further, the silence of the island fell again about Pibby, save for the odd whispering of the leaves and the little airs that came off the sea, and the constant solemn booming of the ocean on the far reach as they lay exposed upon the outward arc of the great reef. And so, listening there and full of the mystery of all the vague and muddled tales that Captain Jat had maundered through so often over the toddy, is it any matter for surprise that the lad Pibby grew suddenly frightened of the loneliness and the silence, and began to think there were pale ovals among the dark tree trunks that peered at him? He thrust his hand down inside his trouser and eased a small double-barreled pistol out of a canvas pocket he had stitched in there with a palm and needle, and sail twine for thread. The feel of the small weapon gave him a degree of comfort, and abruptly he remembered that Captain Jet had told him to keep the boat off in the shadow of the reef. He jumped out over the bows, holding the pistol in his right hand, and found to his dismay that the boat was aground. He put his bare shoulder to her stern and hove madly a while, sweating, for he felt that Captain Jet was quite capable of knifing him on his return if he found the boat hard ashore. With a determination vague but dogged to protect himself with his pistol if necessary, he made one vast final effort, and the boat slid afloat. He jumped in over the bows, ran aft, and put his pistol on the stern thwart. Then with the boat hook he pushed out, and so came in a minute under the gloom of the reef, which rose up there into a chaos of great rocks, weed hidden at their bases. He thrust the boat hook into a mass of weed and anchored the boat temporarily. Then, with a sudden shiver, he remembered his shirt, and having freed it, he covered his damp back. Pibby Tolls had been sitting quietly in the boat for maybe half an hour, when he heard something that made him lean forward on the thwart and listen tensely. There was something moving in among the great rocks and boulders where the reef thrust into the shore, and the sounds were exceedingly curious. Slither, slither, click, click, and then a loud squelch and a great splashing, as if some huge thing scrambling over the rocks had slipped and fallen into one of the pools left by the sea. There was a little time of silence, and then again came the sharp click, click, followed by a loud grating noise over the rocks. The noise frightened the boy extraordinarily, and he freed the boat hook silently from the weed and began nervously to punt the boat out further from the shore, but keeping very carefully in the gloom that the shadow of the reef cast. He held the boat again some dozens fathom further out and waited. He could hear the strange noises continuing, oddly broken by pauses of profound quiet, then again the slithering and clicking sounds. Abruptly there was a loud crash. A huge boulder had been moved bodily and sent rolling down from the higher parts of the reef to the shore. The boulder was a big one, for Pibby could see it vaguely through the darkness, where it had bounded out into the soft sand. He thought vividly and horridly of Captain Jat's muddled yarns of grim things, and he began again silently to push the boat further out. Even as he loosed the hook of the boat hook out from the weed, there came a tremendous scrambling noise among the rocks and shore, and something moved out silently into the vague white sand of the beach. It passed over a darker patch of pebbles, and the lad heard the grounded stones grinding against each other as if under a vast weight. The pistol seemed only a foolish toy in his hand, and he got down suddenly onto the bottom boards of the boat and lay flat. A long while seemed to pass, during which he heard further sounds that told him the thing was moving along the beach. He kept very still, and presently there was only silence of the quiet sea and the island about him again, with the seas booming far and hollowly in the unprotected shores beyond the reef, and the faint stirrings of the forest trees whispering oddly to him across the quiet strip of sea that held the boat off the sand. He sat up cautiously and found that the boat still rose and fell on the gentle heaves of the sea close in under the gloom of the reef. He took the boat hook and anchored her again, and all the time his gaze searched the vague shore, but I saw nothing and heard nothing, and gradually he grew easier. A long time passed while he sat, pistol in hand, watching and listening. Everything remained quiet and slowly began to nod, drowsing and waking through the minutes, so that he could not be said to be either awake or asleep. And then in a moment he was wide awake, for there was a sound breaking the utter stillness. He sat up, gripping his pistol, and stared nervously. And as he stared, the sound came again, a far, faint, inhuman howling, away up through the dark forest, off to the north of him. He stood up in the boat, and abruptly, a great way off in the night, there came the sound of a shot, and once more the howling, only that now there was a strange screaming as well. There was another shot, and one single shrill scream that came to him, far and attenuated out of the night air, and then for the best part of an hour, an absolute silence. Suddenly, far off among the trees, Pibby saw a faint gleam of light, moving here and there and growing bigger as the minutes passed. Presently he saw that there were four of these gleams, and then six, and all moving and dancing about strangely, but no sound, at least not for a time. All at once he heard the snapping of a twig, apparently a long way off in the wood, the sound echoing strangely in the quietness, and then very abruptly and dreadful, the inhuman howling began again, mingled with a wild screaming, seeming to be but a few hundred paces deep in the woods. To the boy it seemed as though something that was half a woman and half something else howled and shrieked there among the trees, and he chilled with a very literal fright. The six lights danced and blended and again separated, and all the time the abominable howling and screaming continued through the grim woods. Then, very sharp and sudden, the noise of one Captain Jack's double-barreled pistols, bang, bang, and almost immediately Captain Jack's voice shouting at some distance to bring the boat in, to bring the boat in. The lad freed the boat hook and started the dinghy into the shore, and as he did so, he heard the crashing of Captain Jack's footsteps through the rotten wood and leaves, and it was plain to him that the captain had started to make an undisguised run for the boat. As Pibby thrust the boat inshore, he realized a number of things. The captain was being followed, and those lights and the strange howling had something to do with whatever followed him. The nose of the boat grounded, and Pibby picked up his weapon and ran forward and stood on the forethwart waiting. The strange lights came nearer, moving swiftly among the trees, and suddenly the lad saw something that was plainly monstrous. He had a clear view up a long vista of dark trees which the lights had made visible, and he saw the figure of a man, black and immensely tall against the light, running and staggering down towards the beach. He knew it was Captain Jack. The dancing lights beyond entered the vista and came dancing and flaring down through the woods, and abruptly the boy got a clear view of the things that carried them. The lights were great torches, and were carried by a number of wild-looking women who were nearly naked, with great manes of hair all loose and wild about them. But the monstrous and horrid thing that caught the boy's eye was something he saw as the women came nearer running. They had faces so flat as to be almost featureless. At first, if he thought at all, he supposed that they were wearing some kind of mask, but as they ran, the nearest woman opened her mouth and howled, the same disgusting sound that he had heard earlier that night. As she howled, she brandished both the hand that held the torch and the other hand above her head. But she had no hands. Her arms ended in enormous claws, like the claws of a great crab. The other women began to howl and to wave their torches and arms as they ran, and Pibby saw that some of them were like the foremost woman. He stared, with the wide-eyed acceptance of youth, of the horrific and monstrous. Captain Jack came blundering and reeling out of the wood. He stubbed his foot against something and fell headlong onto the sand, and those extraordinary and brutish things closed astern of him. Pibby saw suddenly that three of the women had knives, enormous knives. Somehow the sight of the knives made him feel better. It was more human. In the same moment, he loosed off his right barrel and immediately his left, and with each shot there fell a woman, screaming, their torches flying along the sand and throwing up great sparks. Captain Jack staggered up and came on at a heavy run to the boat. He reached it and fell all his great length in over the bows. "Put off, boy," he gasped. "Put off!" And even as he spoke, the boat was away from the shore with a push that he had given it as he came aboard. He scrambled to his feet, seized an oar, and thrust down hard so that the water boiled under the stern with a wave that he gave the boat. In a moment they had the oars between the holes, and they were backing the boat madly out into the darkness of the sea, so that in a few minutes they were a good way off the shore, and the quiet and hush of the water about them. But there danced on the beach at the edge of the sea those monstrous-faced and monstrous-armed women, and howled at them across the sea, and a dreadful enough noise to hear. They waved their great torches and jigged crazily, so that the night splashed redly across the swells, and all the time as they danced their black manes flew about them, and always they howled. "Pull, boy," said Captain Jack, still very hoarse with breathlessness. "Pull, boy." But indeed, the lad was pulling fit to break his youthful back. There passed a further time of labor in gasping silence, and presently they were out in the open water, where the quiet swells moved big and free under them in the darkness, and the reef lay between them and the shore. But they could still see the mad dancing of the light at the edge of the sea. A while later, Captain Jack eased, and they put the boat around, after which he lay on his oar, and the boy the same, for he could scarcely breathe. The lights were gone now from the shore, and there was no sound except the far hollow noise of the breaking seas upon the exposed beaches of the island to the eastward. Now, never a word of thanks, said Captain Jack, for the way the boy had saved him with a pistol, but presently he pulled his oar in across the boat and lit his pipe, after which he hove the plug of his tobacco at the lad. That was his way. Boy, he said, after smoking a little, I'm wondering if they knew I was whistling to her. Who, sir? Asked Pibby. But Captain Jack made no answer to this. After smoking a long time, he said suddenly, Them was the Ood women, boy. Devil women. Priestesses of the Ood. That's devil in their talk. I was here a matter of 4 years gone for water, and I found out something then, boy, about them and their pearl fishing and devil worshipping and how they've kept it quiet from all the world. I found one of the priestesses alone one time, a little woman and pretty, not like them, he jerked his thumb shoreward. I was a week lying off here, and there mightn't have been anyone in the island the way they kept hid, boy, not till I found the little priestess down near by the spring. I knew her lingo a bit. We got talking. I saw her all that week, every night, secret-like. She liked me. I liked her. I had her aboard once, and she told me a heap. When I put her ashore, I took the mate with me, Jeremiah Stimple. He was, and we went prospecting for them pearls I'd learned about. But she never told me proper about the Ood and the Ood women. She'd never say much that way. That's how we got into trouble. We'd near got to the top of the hill, and then come some of them devil women. I was all cut about, and I guess they likely sacrificed the mate. I never saw him again. There must be hundreds of them devil women, sure. They're in them forests. But I always meant to come back, boy. I've seen the pearls this very night. They're down in the bottom of the craters that's inside of yon hills in the middle of the island, all strung around a great carved post, and I'm going to get 'em too, boy. You see the pearls them hag women was dressed with? You mustn't be afeard of their claws, boy. Them only cast off claw shells or something of that sort. Mind you, the little priestess, she says some of them was real, growed that way. But I can't think it scarcely, but you never know what you may find in them sorts of places. What their pet devil is, I don't know.
I saw something, sir, after you was gone, began Pibby, interrupting. It were a horrible thing.
I saw the little priestess tonight down in the crater, went on Captain Jack, without taking the least apparent notice of what the boy had begun to tell him. I was at the top. It's not all of 20 fathom deep. I whistled soft and gentle to her. She saw me and near did faint, boy, by the look of her, and waved me to go away pretty quick. By the look of things down there, they're in for one of their devil festas. Their big torches burning. You can see the light of 'em now. And Captain Jack nodded towards the island. The lad Pibby stared away through the darkness, and surely enough, there was a faint loom of light in the night above the island. I reckon the fest'll be pretty soon now, boy, at the dark of the moon, and like there'll be chiefs from the islands round for 1,000 miles and a sprinkling of rotten whites. I guess in devil worship uncounted. I'm hoping them devil priestesses didn't see the little woman waving me away, or maybe she'll be in bad trouble. They come on me just after she signed to me to clear out, and you finished me before time to slow round. They've butcher's knives, some of 'em, as long as your leg, boy, and one of 'em near ripped me up. He opened his coat, and the lad saw dimly in the gloom that his shirt was all stained dark. I settled for the brutes, Captain Jack continued, and you added too, that 6 gone to hell, where they come from. He broke off and puffed meditatively at his pipe for a time, leaning on his oar, which rested on the gunwales. Pibby had never heard him talk so much before when sober. The native name for yon island means the Island of the Devil, boy, said Captain Jack presently. I heard that years gone for more than one, but none of 'em could tell me anything, or wouldn't, except it was an almighty unhealthy place for a white man, or a native either for that matter, except maybe as I'm thinking when there's one of their big secret damn Ood festas on. He broke off short and slipped his pipe into his pocket. Pull, boy, and break your damn back. There's the ship, he said. 10 minutes later, they were safe aboard. All next day, Captain Jack kept the bark away to the southward of the island, but he sent Pibby aloft time and again with his own telescope, and when the youth came down finally in the late afternoon to report numbers of small crafts on the horizon steering north, he nodded his head as if the news were what he had expected. "Native boats, boy," he said. "Keep your mouth shut and tell nothing to no one. They'll hold that festa tonight, and they have all their pearls strung up, and we'll be there. You clean up all them big double-barreled pistols and load 'em nice and careful, like I've showed you. Get a move on you now." At night, with all the lights doused, the bark stood again to the northward and dropped Captain Jack and the lad in the dinghy off the island. Captain Jack had 4 great pistols in his belt, and he had spent the dog watches in mounting an old duck gun on its swivel in the bow of the boat. Pibby the boy had also 2 big heavy pistols stuck into his belt, not to mention his own small weapon, which reposed snugly in its canvas pocket inside his trousers. They were quite heavily armed. Moreover, he had seen to it this time that the oars were properly muffled. In addition to these preparations, Captain Jack had been very particular concerning the depositing in the boat of a considerable length of chain, with 2 stout padlocks in the ends. Captain Jack took the boat round to the north of the island, and presently, after pulling cautiously for an hour, he bid the lad ease up and lay on his oar a bit, and keep his eyes well skinned. For his part, the captain lay down on his stomach on the thwarts, and spied along the surface of the quietly heaving sea with his night glass. Then suddenly he reached out and caught Pibby a clip with the glass. "Down under the gunwale, boy, or they'll see you," he muttered, and Pibby ducked and slid down under his oar and stared away breathlessly through the darkness to the northward. Now that he had his eyes nearer to the surface of the sea, he discovered the thing that Captain Jack had seen with the night glass. There was a progeny of strings of native boats within 200 fathoms of them, paddling through the night to the island. Pibby counted them and numbered 80, but probably missed some in the darkness. Captain Jack allowed these crafts to get well inshore, then taking his oar, he shoved it out through a steering grommet, which he had fixed up in the stern, and began to scull steadily after them, but allowing nothing more than his hand and his forearm to rise above the gunwale of the boat. As the dinghy crept into the wake of those silent craft ahead, the boy noticed suddenly that there had come again above the island the strange loom of light that he had seen the night before. Presently the heave of the sea had almost died from under the boat, and it was plain they had come under the lee of some outjutting lie of rocks. The last of the craft ahead vanished into the shadow of the island, but Captain Jack had marked the place and followed dead on. A minute later they saw the shore directly ahead, not a score fathoms away, but there was no beach, only the dark trees of bushes coming right down apparently to the water's edge. There was no heave at all now under the boat, so that they had evidently been piloted into a perfectly sheltered cove. Captain Jack kept the boat going straight ahead. He made no attempt to slacken her way, despite the fact that they seemed to be heading straight ashore into the middle of a heavy underwood. The bows of the dinghy reached the dank bushes, where they hung out over the water, and Captain Jack took both hands to his oar and forced her in among them. For a few moments the overgrowth seemed to smother the boat, all wet and slimy and rank. Then the boat had passed clean through into open water beyond. Pibby the lad stared in front into the darkness, but could see nothing. He looked upward and saw a narrow winding ribbon of night sky far above them, which told him that Captain Jack had discovered the way into a deep-set tidal passage, the mouth of which was completely masked by the undergrowth and overhanging trees. It was obviously a huge crack through the side of the low crater, which the sea had turned into a creek. Very cautiously, Captain Jack sculled ahead. It was like sculling into a pitch-black night, so black that the far upward ribbon of night sky seemed almost to shine by comparison. As they went, little hollow sobbing sounds of the water in the crannies of the unseen rocky sides came to them, dankly and somehow drearily. But Captain Jack handled the sculling oar so softly that not once did the clinker-built entry of the boat mutter on the water. And this way quite half an hour passed, though it seemed much longer, going utterly slow and silent and cautious in that grim dark, and steering by the winding pattern of the night sky above, and by the odd vague sense which told the captain when they were come over near to one side or the other in the darkness. Once, as they went so quiet and stealthy, there came to them, indefinitely, out of the night a far howling, once and then again, and later, an attenuated, incredibly shrill screaming, that died away and left the boy frightened and holding the stocks of his heavy pistols. But Captain Jat sculled steadily on. Abruptly, Captain Jat ceased sculling and stood silent. It was plain to the lad that as he was either listening or staring intently, and the boy peered round, every way nervously, suddenly he saw an indefinite glow of light ahead, evidently beyond a bend in the narrow creek. The glow grew rapidly into a bright light that danced and flickered, and in the space of a minute there came round the bend of the creek, upon the left side, two of those brutish things that had followed the captain the night before. They were running through the stunted trees and bushes, parallel with the course of the creek, but about 20 feet above the level of the water, winding in and out as they went, among the trees and great bushes that grew up in the steep lower slope of the creek side. Their agility was incredible. Here and there they leaped like goats from rock to rock, their torches dripping and flaring as they ran, one behind the other. Captain Jat stood motionless in the stern of the dinghy, with his oar in one hand and one of his pistols in the other. He watched the two beastly creatures run by, and the boy, glancing at him swiftly in his fright, saw that his face was perfectly calm, but the lights from the torches seemed to glow in his eyes, so that they shone almost like the eyes of a wild animal. The lad's gaze jumped back to the two running brutes. He could not see their hideous flat faces, for their great manes, all loose and wild, hung over them, damp and black and matted, as if they were fresh come out of the sea. And indeed, there was rank, wet weed, all entangled in their hair, for he saw it glisten in the blaze of the torches. Yet, though he could not see their faces, he saw their arms from their naked shoulders downward. The arms of the foremost woman ended in two monstrous claws, but the boy saw plainly that they were no more than cast-off shells of some huge sea reptile. If I may so describe it, he saw where they ended, rough and rude, just below her elbows, and that her right hand came through a hole between the mandibles of the claw to hold her great sword. But the second woman gave him a horrible feeling. He could not see where her arm ended and the claws began. He remembered what the little priestess had told Captain Jat, and even as he stared frightened and horrified, the two creatures were gone past. He saw then that the foremost one had an ugly great knife stuck naked into the back of a kind of broad belt, and the belt was all stitched with what at first he took to be a big shining beads. Then he realized that perhaps they were not beads, but pearls, as the captain had told him. Yet it was less of that possible fortune in pearls that Pibby Talls, the boy, thought in that tense moment, than of the fact that he could not see where the arms of the second woman ended and the claws began. Then the two running, leaping, bestial things were gone away down the creek, and a minute after they were out of sight round one of the rocky bends, and all was dark again about the boat. The dinghy began to move ahead once more in the darkness as Captain Jat took up work again with a sculling oar. A matter of some 10 minutes of silence passed, with the water of the creek making odd gurglings and echoes on either hand among the crannies and holes in the rocks, when Pibby realized that the enormous steep sides of the creek had joined overhead, and that they were moving forward through the complete blackness of an invisible cavern. And then, even as he realized the fact uneasily, there showed far ahead a small bright spot of light. The boat began to sway, and a little murmur broke out under her bows as Captain Jat increased the speed, but eased it at once, for the faint noise of the water under her entrance made a strangely loud sound in that silence. But still they moved ahead steadily, and that speck of light grew until the lad saw that it was an inner mouth to the cavern, and beyond it some bright flaring light. The boat approached unseen in the darkness of the cavern to within a dozen fathoms of this newly discovered entrance, and for the last minute Pibby had been staring with a fixed and astounded interest at what he saw. The arc of the cave mouth must have been fully 30 feet high, and the width of it a little less, and through this great opening Pibby was looking into a big circular space, apparently several 100 feet across, the walls of which went up out of his sight into the darkness above. But what fixed both his and Captain Jat's attention was the center portion of this extraordinary natural amphitheater, for in the center was a small lake of seawater, maybe about 60 feet across, and out of the center of the lake there rose a weed-hung hump of rock, and from the center of the hump of rock there rose a great pole, maybe 50 feet in height, black through all its length and polished so highly that reflected brilliantly the light of 6 enormous torches that burned on the tops of 6 great pillars that stood up out of the rock all round the central pool or lake. And this pole, from its grotesquely carved head, flat faced and repulsive to its base, where it had been cut into the shape of a bunch of huge claws, was banded every few feet with strings of countless beads that glimmered in a semi-luminous fashion in the flare of the torchlights, and every bead was a pearl. The water from the cavern in which the dinghy floated ran in a perfectly straight channel into the central pool or lake, and the weeded floor of the ancient crater rose a foot or so on each side, spreading away then in one level brown weed-covered reach to the great walls of the inside of the low mountain. The torches showed that the bottom parts of the mountain walls were all grown with weed, to a height of about 6 feet above the bottom of the crater, so that it was plain that the sea, entering through the creek in the cavern, rose at high tide to at least that height, in which case there would only be the 6-inch torches and the lofty polished black poles in the center, with its profusion of strings of pearls visible when the tide was up. It must have been a strange sight then, even a stranger than when Captain Jat and Pibby looked out from the cavern. And now, but not very distinctly in that light, Pibby saw where all that great line of boats had gone to. For there, so far as he could see, all around the bottom of the great natural amphitheater, were the boats, where they had been drawn up head to stern upon the weed, and scarcely seen above the weed, out of which they rose only a little except for their lofty head and stern timbers, which, however, had been so draped with weed as to blend with the weed-grown walls beyond. Over the sides of all these boats, and there were vastly more than the flotilla that they had followed in, for they lay side by side, apparently 3 or 4 deep, Captain Jat and the lad saw the heads of hundreds and hundreds of natives, all but vague and indistinct, both because of the uncertain flaring of the great torches, and because each native had dressed her head with a mass of weed. Indeed, it would have been easy to have entered the crater under the impression that there was no more life in it than the blaze of the huge torches. As Pibby strained his eyes to make out the boats, wondering whether it had been hard to drag them up out of the creek and across the weed, he felt the dinghy beginning to move silently back into the cavern, and turning he saw that Captain Jat was using his oar noiselessly as an Indian uses his paddle, and so fetching the boat gently astern. In this way they progressed for about 100 yards, and then Captain Jat set the dinghy into the side and began to grope along. Presently he gave out a little grunt of satisfaction and pushed the boat across to the other side, but was evidently unable to find what he wanted, for he continued to punt the boat astern with his hands until the great opening of the cave appeared no more than a distant speck of light. Then he grunted again and immediately sent the boat across once more to the other side. A minute later he gave out a further note of satisfaction, and suddenly Pibby heard his voice muttering to him to pass up one end of the chain and one of the padlocks. He heard the captain fumbling for a time, and the odd slight clinking of the chain. Then the dinghy was thrust out again, and Captain Jack was bidding him pay out the chain gently without a sound, while he paddled the boat once more across. They reached the other side, and Pibby's grasped his master's idea, which was obviously to put a chain boom across slickly, so that if they had to retreat in a hurry, they would pass over it, then tauten it up, and padlock it in position, and so get away easily while all the boats of the pursuers ran afoul of the boom. The boy ran his hands in along the chain, where the captain was working, and found that he was anchoring it around a huge boulder. Pibby had no doubt but that the other end was quite as efficiently secured, and he began to feel comfortable again in his mind. It was such an efficient retreat. Then, as he sat in the darkness, he fell to wondering just what those natives were waiting for, all hid with weed like they were, and the great torches, and the huge carved and polished pole with a fortune of splendid pearls strung around it. And then, as he worried, the thought over nervously in his mind. He thrilled suddenly, for Captain Jack was once more sculling the boat ahead towards the brightly shining arc of the cavern's entrance into the arena. Abruptly, as the boat forged ahead, there came a queer swirl deep down in the dark water, somewhere astern of the boat, that sent little waves onto the sides of the gloomy cavern, breaking in the darkness with a multitudinous chattering of liquid sounds. Something huge passed under the boat, which was now approaching the entrance at a fair speed. They felt the great thing pass under them, deep below the surface, but drawing after it a wave that humped the boat up, stern first, and then the bows. "My God," said Captain Jack huskily aloud. "The Ood!" His voice came back, husky and breadful, from a thousand places in the darkness. "My God, the Ood! My God, the Ood!" And in the same moment, Pibby felt the dinghy began to sway heavily, and heard Captain Jack gasp as he began sculling with a kind of mad violence, whispering, "Little priestess! Little priestess! My God! They saw her waving my—" Pibby never heard any more, for they had come sufficiently near the ark now for him to be able to see again into the crater with some clearness. He stared in complete and dreadful amazement, for though the whole of the great amphitheater was as silent as when they left, there was now a little naked brown woman, lashed by her neck, her waist, and her ankles to the great pearl-string central pole that came up out of the hump of rock in the pool. She had been brought there and made fast during the time in which they had been fixing up the chain boom. That was why the weed-hidden boats waited. She was a sacrifice, the thing that had passed on the boat. She had been seen waving to the captain. She— The chaos of his thoughts stilled abruptly into a fearful attention. He bent forward from his forethwart and stared, almost petrified. Something was coming up out of the water, climbing up onto the hump of rock. Enormous legs were coming up out of the pool, scrambling at the rock, slipping, and tearing away great chunks of the weed, and finally effecting a hold. A moment afterwards, a thing like a vast brown, shell-encrusted dish cover, as big as an ordinary old-fashioned old mahogany table, began to rise up out of the pool. The boy shook as he stared. He did not know that such things existed. A crab. That was no word for it. It was a monster, capable of destroying an elephant. He remembered the great thing that had slipped and slithered among the big rocks at the inshore end of the reef. The thing was rising higher and higher. Nothing could save the woman. Nothing on earth. They had better get away at once before it discovered them. The thing was reaching out three of its great pincer-armed legs towards the little brown woman, who began now to scream in a peculiar, breathless voice. Then Pibby was suddenly caught by the shoulder from behind, and Captain Jack dashed him aft into the stern sheets of the dinghy out of his way. As he fell, he saw Captain Jack against the light. He had the great duck gun in his hand. Pibby remembered that it was loaded with the thick end of a broken marlin spike. There was a rip of fire that coincided with the flashes of light he saw as his head met the stern thwart. There was a crashing thump of sound that added to the muddle of his fall, and Captain Jack pitched bodily backwards onto the top of him, literally felled by the recoil of the big weapon. The boy screamed, and everything went gray for a moment. Then Captain Jack rolled free of him, and that same moment there was a vast thrashing of water, and the boat was cast up a yard into the air by a wave that came traveling down the cavern from the crater. The dinghy slewed half around, rolled heavily, and shipped several gallons, then steadied. Pibby staggered to his feet, shaken and sick. He stared toward the pool. The water appeared to be boiling all about the hump of rock, but there was no sign of the thing that had come up out of the water. The boiling motion of the water began to ease, and Pibby saw that the little brown woman sagged in her lashings against the carved black pole, but there was no mark on her to show that she had been hurt. She had become unconscious. The next thing he knew, he had an oar in his hand, and Captain Jack had another, and they were out of the great cavern and pulling madly up the channel that cut across the floor of the crater to the pool. He noticed with a curious inconsequence that he could now see trees far up at the top of the walls of the crater, shaking a little in the night wind against the stars. The boat bumped into the masses of weed about the hump of the rock, and Captain Jack gave one great spring upward and was onto the rock, having used his oar against the bottom boards as a kind of vaulting pole. His effort forced the boat away, but Pibby grabbed the boat hook, jabbed it into a mass of the weed, and pulled her back. He saw Captain Jack sawing savagely at the lashings, and was conscious for the first time that the crater was full of wild yelling. He saw his master pluck the little brown woman loose, and the next woman she was hove down onto the boat with a crash. He did not look at her, but Captain Jack. Captain Jack was reaching up, slashing at the lowest strings of great pearls. The string gave, and the pearls went spraying and bounding all over the hump of rock into the water, but Captain Jack had secured a handful. A spear struck the polished pole, chipping it, and flew off into the side, passing through Captain Jack's sleeve. The boy glanced once now around at the arena, and saw suddenly that there was literally hundreds and hundreds of natives, scrambling and slipping and sleeping over the weed-covered floor towards them. He saw also another thing. Two of the horrible clawed-armed women were slashing at a native with their great knives. It may have been the man who had thrown the spear and chipped the post. The post was obviously an incredibly sacred thing. He heard his own voice shouting eagerly to the Captain Jack to come, but that indomitable length of man had swarmed a fathom up the polished pole and was cutting loose another string of pearls. There came a shower of them bounding onto the rock and into the weed and water, but again Captain Jack had secured a share. He gave one leap to the rock and another into the boat, then stern foremost they rowed grimly for the opening into the cavern. One of the savages, a huge fat man, had outdistanced the others in spite of his fat. Perhaps his fat accounted for it, for he had come across a slippery weed creeping on hands and feet, and had therefore lost no time in falling in. He rose up at the edge of the channel, but as he made to spring the boat, he slipped and fell squelching on his back, and Captain Jack pistoled him calmly as he lay. Yet now the danger was appalling, for scores of the natives were getting near, and a shower of spears came over the boat. Four of them striking her starboard quarter and making it look literally rather like a gigantic pincushion. But no one was hurt, though the captain's clothing was cut into places. They replied with their heavy pistols and left a dozen of the natives dead, and so managed to ram the dinghy stern first into the cavern. Captain Jack put the boat round, and as soon as they were well out of sight, and they both settled down to pull. Yet when they had gone about 100 fathoms, they heard a splash, and saw that one of the smaller native boats had already been hauled across the weed and was now in the water of the channel. They knew that in another few minutes there would be scores of boats after them. Half a minute later, Pibby's oar stubbed against the slack chain of the boom, and they in oars and hauled the boat along to the side of the cavern, being now on the seaward side of the boom. Captain Jack worked desperately, and Pibby lighted the chain up against him so as to get it as taut as possible. Yet it took time, for they were in utter darkness. But the chain must be taut if it were to act as a boom. Otherwise the natives would manage either to shove their boats under or over it. And all the time as they worked, boats were entering the mouth of the great cavern, with torches held high above their bows to show them the way, while the boats that had been first launched into the creek were now scarcely 150 feet away. And still Captain Jack growled to Pibby to light up the slack! Light up the slack! The small boat came on steadily, until she was no more than 70 or 80 feet away, and suddenly a great shout told Captain Jack and the boy that the light of the distant torches must have picked them out in the blackness. Immediately afterwards, all around them in the water, there was plunk, plunk, the noise of thrown spears. There came a sharp chinking sound as a single spear struck the rocky side. A glance gashed along the captain's face and took away a part of his ear. He swore grimly and gave one more pull on the chain, then closed the big padlock and locked it with a swift deliberation. Immediately afterward, he fetched a spare pistol out of the side pocket and loosed off into the approaching boat with such a good aim that one of his bullets punched a hole in two of the men who happened to be in a line. Then, dropping his pistol into the bottom of the boat, he sprang to his oar, and a minute later they were away round the bend, bumping heavily in the darkness against the rocky side of the cavern and listening to the fierce outcry that came echoing along the cavern as the boom opposed all progress for the time being. "Done 'em, boys," said Captain Jack. "Now pull easy. We don't want the boat stove. Backwater when I sings out." And therewith the two settled down to work the oars. Some 40 minutes later, they passed through the screen of overhanging bushes and trees that marked the mouth of the creek, and were presently out into the wholesome sweetness of the sea, which the island no more than a shape of darkness astern. Yet when they came to look for the little brown woman, she had gone. It was evident that she had come to and slipped overboard in the darkness, preferring, it appears, to face any risk that the island might contain for her, than to face the facing of the unknown. "The ship, boy, pull!" said Captain Jack, a little while afterwards. And indeed the ship it was, and soon they were safely aboard, steering northward, away from the island, for good this time. Down in his cabin, with the door safely closed, yet not without more than one suspicious glance towards it, Captain Jack was presently conning over and exhibiting to Pibby his spoils. On the table was a jug, a very special toddy, and Captain Jack was investigating it with the aid of his big pewter mug. Pibby also, must be confessed, had adopted a fair-sized drinking cup for the same purpose, for Captain Jack allowed him only the one and no more. It may be that the unusual richness of the toddy developed a latent generosity in the lean captain, for after a lot of fingering and weighing and examining, he resented Pibby as his share one of the smallest of the pearls, which had been somehow badly chipped. Pibby Tull's cabin boy, deckhand, call him what you will, took the little damaged pearls with sufficient evidence of gratitude. He could afford to, for inside his shirt there reposed a number of pearls, as fine as any that Captain Jack had brought away with him. The boy had picked them off the bottom boards of the dinghy, where they had fallen when his master cut the strings of pearls about the sacred pole. In short, we may conclude, I think, that whatever else he might be, Pibby Tull's was one who had a very sound eye to the main chance, a conclusion which a further adventure of Captain Jack's has rather impressed upon me.